In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
You walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. On this show, we've gone in depth in a series called Walk Among Us, exploring the concept of non-humans masquerading as humans, living among us as a parasitical species. One of these shows was an interview with noted science fiction cartoonist and author Ray Nelson. In addition to having written numerous novels and short stories, Ray's short story titled 8 o'clock in the Morning was made into the paranoid cult classic film They Live, directed by John Carpenter. Ray Nelson passed in November 29th, 2022 in Napa, California. In memory of Ray, we listened to his 2014 interview. Ray explains how he was hired on as a writer for the film They Live and what it was like working with John Carpenter and the main actors. Ray also parallels the destruction of the tent city in the film with a similar event destroying the Occupy movement nationwide. Now, 11 years since the interview, the parallels with current reality in the 1988 film continue to emerge. One of the areas explored in the Walk Among Us series here on In Other News looked at how the intruders blended in with human society undetected. In the film They Live, a ubiquitous broadcast of a specific frequency caused the aliens to appear as human. In our reality, the environment is saturated with the pulsed microwave radiation broadcast nearly 24/7. While a lockdown was imposed upon the world in 2020, fifth generation millimeter wave radiation systems were covertly installed in public schools and in many other human environments. Chronic exposure to this invisible rainbow is known to cause a range of acute symptoms, including cancer. How similar is blanketing human environments with a micro and millimeter wave frequency to the use of the camouflaging frequency in the film They Live? As you'll hear Ray Nelson explain, the entities in the film are an alien race, not demons or invisible archons. However, in the second part of the December 2021 interview with Carissa Conti, we explored how so many in healthcare, school boards, law enforcement, local, state, and government agencies did everything they could to take down society during the engineered pandemic. Carissa describes how the demonic alien elements operate and take over people. For more context, we hear an excerpt of that interview with Carissa Conti.
You know, when it comes to the neg energy operating throughout our world and through these people that in these strategically placed COVID agenda pods, this neg energy is not all the same. There actually seems to be, you know, roughly two main types of neg energy that I've seen and experienced firsthand. One is an alien or almost like an AI-ish type of energy. And one is more just straight up kind of demonic. I mean, and technically both are demonic, you could say, but the first one has different characteristics, in my opinion, and manifests differently from what I've seen and experienced. So I call that first one, I call it the cold, cruel devil's energy, and that comes from Stuart Wilde way back in the day. That was a term he used to describe some of these neg people. But, you know, they're like stony face with these monotone, apathetic voices, just icy cold indifference, zero empathy, humorless, kind of blank, you know, and as mentioned, it's an almost like an AI or a cold alien type of energy. And it's operating in this 10, 10, 10, like computer programmed agenda way. It cannot be reasoned with or swayed, just completely impervious to emotion. They can create and dole out injury, death, or policies that lead to death without a second thought. They know what they're doing, though, and do truly enjoy it. So we'll occasionally slip into that whole glinty-eyed, smirking thing that I've mentioned earlier in our discussion, you know, showing mocking or disdain. And with regards to the people out in the world tying into this poison jab agenda and the pandemic and the lockdowns and the enforcement of all this, groups of people that I have seen out there that I think kind of both, you know, best represent this energy would be those medical and hospital staff and administrators, those school boards we're always hearing about now, where you have these really upset and emotional parents standing before these school boards at these meetings and just pleading with them to please stop masking the kids, stop requesting the jab, stop teaching these horrible woke curriculums, and the school boards are just completely impervious to it. They just stare at them blank, apathetic, very cold. They'll just coldly tell them your time is up, or even worse, just shut off their mics when they're in the middle of talking, or even smirk amongst themselves, which the parents have called out, like, yeah, I see you smirking up there. But, you know, so it's that cold, smirky, it's just like an alien that can't be reasoned with, like a computer program. It's gross. And then you have the actual, you know, demonic energy.
That was an excerpt of the December 2021 interview with Carissa Conti to show another parallel with the film They Live. Actually, the aliens in the film They Live seemed nicer than the cold, emotionless, blank-faced purveyors of the engineered pandemic democide. If you want to learn more about what happened during that engineered pandemic, I recommend reading Naomi Wolf's book titled The Pfizer Papers. Let's go now to hear the interview with the late Ray Nelson. In the 1988 paranoid cult classic film They Live, directed by John Carpenter, a homeless drifter stumbles upon the reason for the massive economic disparities among the rich and poor. It's because society has been infiltrated by non-human beings who have disguised their grotesque features so they appear human and blend in undetected. Rowdy Roddy Piper, a famous wrestler, is cast as the hero of the film. He's found an underground group preparing to stop the invasion. The group manufactured a special type of sunglasses that can, quote, see through the alien glamour and exposes them trying to blend in among the human race. The sunglasses also reveal subliminal messages on money, signage, and in all media that's constantly hypnotizing human minds into a trance of consumption and compliance. The film They Live was based on the short story 8 O'Clock in the Morning, published in November 1963 by Ray Nelson. Ray worked with John Carpenter to rewrite his short story for the film. Ray Nelson is a science fiction author and cartoonist. He joins us to talk about his work, his friend, science fiction writer Philip K. Dick, and the making of the movie They Live, plus its two sequels that were banned by the movie industry. Ray Nelson, welcome to Another News.
Thank you.
Can you tell listeners how you came to write the story 8 O'Clock in the Morning?
Well, one afternoon, I was thinking about how people were doing things that were against their interests, as if they were being controlled by some malevolent force. And I got out a piece of paper and began to scribble, and 8 O'Clock in the Morning was the result. I sent it in to Fantasy and Science Fiction magazine, and they took it right away, and that pleased me highly. And much later, I did another version of it as a comic book story in Alien Encounters Comics, and that proved to my satisfaction that they do read something in Hollywood, because even though that story had gotten a number of awards, and in the meantime, Hollywood had never noticed until it appeared as a comic book. So I know for sure that in Hollywood they're reading comic books.
Tell listeners about that comic book, please.
Well, there was a period when there were a lot of independent comic books being published, and one of them was edited by somebody that I knew, So I just suggested that I could do a comic book version, and she said, sure. And so I drew it up, and another guy inked it and did the colors, and there it appeared in Alien Encounters Comics. Cat Ironwood, by the way, was the name of the editor.
Now, can you go through the storyline a little bit for listeners who aren't familiar with the cult classic They Live or 8 o'clock in the morning?
Well, the basic plot is that the world is being run by space monsters, but nobody knows because they're hypnotized. But one guy wakes up and he starts battling against the overwhelming odds of the space monsters. And even though he is killed in the struggle, he manages to broadcast a wake-up call to the human race about the space monsters.
Very disturbing. I think what really affects people is the aloneness of finding out such a reality, because if you're the only one who sees this, it's terrifying, number one, but no one else will believe you. That's a very interesting dynamic that you created. You were born in Schenectady, New York, and
That's right. And
you moved to Paris at a very important time. Can you tell listeners about that experience and how it may have influenced your writing?
Well, I went to Paris almost by accident because I was at a party where Hillbilly Band that was going to be playing on a cruise ship was having a wild time, but their backup guitarist was busted for drugs, and there they were, hours away from sailing time. And it just happened that I not only knew all their songs, but I also had a passport in my pocket. So after a pleasant voyage playing a backdrop guitar, I landed in Paris, and I had money to get back home, but instead I sort of fell in love with Paris and stayed there, and for a while was just barely surviving. But I got a job as a clerk at the English language bookstore, which then was called Le Mistral, and it's now called Shakespeare and Company. And there I met Allen Ginsberg and a number of the other, what you might call beatnik poets. And also I made the acquaintance of the hardcore of the existentialist movement. In particular, I had a fairly close relationship with Jean-Paul Sartre, but he was kind of a grumpy guy. And Simone de Beauvoir, actually, was more of an inspiration to me than him, because both Simone and I were great walkers. So we would walk all over Paris talking, and the other existentialists were all, in one way or another, sick or lazy. And I got a huge amount of help on the first story that of mine that was ever published, which was Turn Off the Sky. That also appeared in Fantasy and Science Fiction magazine.
Can you tell us about that influence that you got to write that story, and tell listeners what that story is about?
Okay. As I say, the name of the story is Turn Off the Sky, and it's based on a lot of conversations that I had with writers in the Sartre group, and including the ending, which Simone actually wrote. It's got a very strong ending, stronger than the one that I had. It's embodying the idea that if we ever do manage to have a perfect society, there'll still be imperfect people in it, and so that will not be the end of our problem. The basic plot outline is that there's an anarchist who is circulating about in society and riding on the subway back and forth under the Atlantic Ocean, because they have a transatlantic subway. And in the end, he's waiting for his girlfriend, who's been kind of inspiration for him the way Simone was for me. Only a terrorist blows up the subway underneath the Atlantic Ocean, and so the girlfriend never arrived. But she has already affected the philosophy and attitude of our hero, and it's implied that he will go on to lead a productive life, a somewhat sadder one. And this story, it's sort of a classic in itself. It's been translated a lot.
Would you say that you were also politically influenced, spending time with other writers in Paris?
Yes, I definitely would. They cured me of my fear of socialism, because they were democratic socialists, but that was not the same thing as being a communist, which seemed to have been the attitude of people in the USA. And so I would say probably I could be now classified as a democratic socialist. And there's a sneaky democratic socialist theme creeping under 8 o'clock in the morning, because 8 o'clock in the morning is sort of a metaphor for what we now call the 1% that are the ruling class of this planet.
This is very interesting, Ray. This is a very interesting element here. That's something I didn't really notice. But you were mentioning that these monsters at the time, as a joke, were considered, oh, these are the Republicans.
No, I don't think very many people caught on. But unfortunately, the backers who were Republicans, they caught on, and they canceled two sequels that were already scheduled and had even been slightly shot. The special effects for They Live 2 were used in the promotion of They Live 1. But no more money. And the guy who was pushing the cart onto the lot selling snacks, he and John Carpenter were not allowed to be on the set for years. And John Carpenter, when he finally got back on, always had a so-called secretary following him around, making sure he was a good boy.
That, I always wondered if there was going to be a They Live 2, or it was even considered. And I even, in the end of They Live, that hypnotic beam on the top of the TV station was blown up. Mm-hmm. And so the spell was broken. Everybody could see what these creatures were and what was in their landscape. And then I was thinking, well, they contain the disaster in some way, rebuild another device to restructure the hypnotic trance, revise history as if this never happened, and it's 50 years later, and you have remnants of a revolution in the past, but no one's quite sure what really happened.
Well, that's one possibility, but the possibility that I wrote was that someone from our planet goes to their planet and stirs up the fires of rebellion on the home planet of space monsters. John Carpenter thought it was fine, and a lot of people who had worked on this show thought it was fine, but unfortunately, John, in an interview for, I guess it was a fan magazine for science fiction films, he let slip that part about it being a satire on the Republicans, and the Republicans heard the broadcast. And were they unhappy? They thought this was just a cheap money-making monster film, and here we had subversively snuck in a political message.
You could substitute Republican for a lot of different things, so to take it so personally was quite revealing.
I guess so, but one thing that happened in my movie, and that is there was an Occupy movement. And now there is an Occupy movement. A lot of the action took place in an Occupy movement camp. That's where the space monsters, proxies in the form of the police department, smash up all the improvised dwellings of the occupiers.
When they were destroying the Occupy camps here in New York, there were scenes right from that, like the bulldozing down of the tents. You actually saw that in Philadelphia, New York. So you were probably thinking this aspect has materialized in the real world.
Well, that's about what I thought. I was as surprised as anybody because I thought I was writing fiction. But science fiction has this weird ability to materialize in our own universe from time to time.
When you came back from Paris, what happened then?
Well, I got a job. First of all, I was selling subscriptions to the Encyclopedia Britannica door-to-door, and that didn't work out. And then a couple of other jobs, and then there came a time when I heard that if I went to Los Angeles, I could meet with Avram Davidson, the editor of Fantasy and Science Fiction magazine, or I could go for a job interview as a computer programmer, because I had some training in that line. And so there was an agonized reconsideration of my life, and I hopped in my car and went to Los Angeles and confronted Avram Davidson, editor of that magazine, and he bought it.
Can you talk about the Berkeley Coven of Writers? Who was involved and what concepts were being explored?
Well, really, all of the writers who were writing fantasy, and some of them weren't writing fantasy, but it began as a class in novel writing at the Berkeley Free University. And when the Berkeley Free University collapsed, we continued to meet in private homes. But I've just really realized how many stellar names there were who were members of the Berkeley Coven. Here's Philip K. Dick, my collaborator on the Ganymede Takeover. Here's Anne Wright. Here's Marion Zimmer Bradley, who wrote The Mists of Avalon, which was a number one on the New York Times bestseller list. Here's Richard Lupall. Here's Chelsea Quinn Yarbrough, who followed Anne Rice's example and had a world in which vampires secretly existed behind the scenes. And here's Trina Robbins, who wrote a fantasy about what's called Catwalk, about a planet in which intelligent cats occupied along with human beings. And here's Robert Lee Hall. He wrote a story in which the alternateness of reality was that Professor Moriarty from the Sherlock Holmes story, he was a time traveler. And there's more names on here, but that's enough.
It must have been really amazing to experience that and share all these ideas. And some of the ideas being written about was the uncertainty of reality, parallel timelines, and
That's right. And
the Matrix reality.
Yep.
And these are themes that your colleague, friend, and author Philip K. Dick used often in his work.
That's true. Maybe you don't know, or maybe you do, but as of today, Philip K. Dick's books are the most movieized of all time.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, well, Phil, Arnold Schwarzenegger wouldn't have a career without Phil.
Blade Runner, you have a Scanner Darkly.
And so on.
And so on. And these are blockbuster movies that have changed the style of movies and has revolutionized science fiction as a genre.
Mm-hmm.
But being a friend of Philip K. Dick in that time, in the mid-60s, I was watching this documentary called The Penultimate Truth.
And
great documentary. They were pointing out that the FBI was investigating you and Philip. What was going on there? Why would that happen?
Well, both Phil and I had been peripherally involved in the Berkeley Free University, which from the FBI's point of view was a communist front. Phil was the first one to really realize what was going on. He was sitting in his front room and there was a car out in front. He looked out the front window and he says, "That car's been here for days. I wonder why." And his wife, Nancy, of that time, he said, "Oh, the government may be spying on you." And Phil says, "I'll bet that's it." So he went out and he knocked on the window. The guy rolls down the window and Phil says, "You're spying on me for the FBI, aren't you?" And there's this long pause. And the guy says, "Yeah, that's right." And Phil says, "Don't you think you could spy on me better if you just came in and had breakfast with me?" And so the FBI guy went into Phil's house and sat down and had breakfast. And on the other side of the table, there was an actual drug pusher who was also sharing breakfast with us. And Phil and the FBI agent got to be such good pals that the FBI agent taught his wife how to drive.
Oh, my gosh. So it wasn't as weird and paranoid and upsetting as one might think, being under surveillance by the FBI.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, we're now living in the post-Snowden era. And it looks like, according to all the actual facts that Snowden is digging up, that Phil's idea of reality was a lot closer to the accepted reality of everybody else.
Yet it was resisted with everybody's ability, running from that possibility of it being true. And that's a very interesting element of human nature when confronted with a dark piece of truth in our reality. Anne Rice was among the Berkeley Coven, and can you talk about what she was doing with the idea of vampires at that time, and what it symbolized for her?
Well, she was a regular here, but she was doing mainstream novels instead of fantasy. Mainstream novels that just couldn't seem to find a publisher. And she was really upset because her husband was the famous poet, Stan Rice, who wrote White Boy and was a teacher, and all of his friends were getting published, and poor Anne was not getting published. She was actually sort of crying here. And I said, well, Anne, what kind of books do you read? She said, I just read cheap vampire books. And I said, well, then maybe that's what you should be writing. You seem to like that kind of thing. How about going home, and for next week you can bring me a first chapter of a vampire book. So she went home, and she wrote the first chapter of Interview with a Vampire. And everybody was cheering after she got finished reading. And so she finished the book, and Stan's agent sold it for her, and it was so popular that options of various sorts for it were pouring in before it even rolled off the press. And she made more than $1 million before the first copy came off the press. And since then, every sequel that she's written to that has been a bestseller and been made into a movie. I think the thing is with all of us that everybody kind of suspects that there's monstrous activities taking place secretly. And that's the reason why Phil's books and my books and Anne Rice's books and so forth, they're so popular because they strike a suspicion that everybody has, that there's a sinister plot going on behind the scenes.
It's a very important thing to identify here, especially when Philip K. Dick was very open about his suspicions, and he had evidence that something very bizarre was going on, and some of his suspicions were confirmed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's fascinating how writers, you know, arrive at a dissociative model of reality,
mm-hmm.
where not everyone is human, but they look human. Now, Hunter S. Thompson, for example, saw people turn into reptiles. John Keel was convinced at one point that there are humans who look like everyone else, but they were androids, robots.
Mm-hmm.
And there are similar themes of the other in books, short stories, the Bible with mm-hmm. the wheat and the tare, popular movie and TV series, V for Visitors. And that made a comeback, I think, in 20...
Oh, I remember V.
Yes.
I guess that the lady who played a role in that was also in They Live.
Oh, which one was that?
I'm trying to think. It's the one with the clear blue eyes and the far-off expression.
I never understood if she was one of them in the movie because she didn't appear as a monster in the glasses.
Mm-hmm.
What was going on there? Why her?
No, in the movie she is not actually one of the monsters. She's just a collaborator, that's the best word. She herself is a human being.
Yes, very striking, clear blue eyes.
So she looks weird, like she might be a monster, but she's not.
V is a similar construct in that these monsters who have invaded look human, and they have a human shell around them. It's not a system designed to hypnotize people like you've constructed, which I thought was interesting. But you still have the others walking among the human family, disguising themselves, which in nature, that's a very... It's a very strong behavior, such as adaptive camouflage, octopus, chameleons, as you pointed out. The mark of a good predator is to act like its prey.
There you go. You know, I get fan letters a lot from people who ask the same question. They say, do you really believe that space monsters are ruling us? And I have to tell them that at the time I wrote it, I was pretty sure I was writing fiction. But history is beginning to prove that I was accidentally right.
Well, I'd like to explore that idea. Why do you think 8 o'clock in the morning struck a chord with people and became the foundation for this cult classic film, They Live? The element of hypnosis is interesting here. It's another reference to altered state of consciousness, whether it's sunglasses, an altered perception, drugs, Hunter S. Thompson as well.
Yeah, that's right.
Sunglasses, drugs, or hypnosis being used.
So I was picked hypnosis because familiar with hypnosis as a part of a sort of a science fiction religion called Scientology, which uses a form of hypnosis as part of their therapy. So I knew the powerful things that hypnosis could do, make people believe things don't exist when they do, or do exist when they don't.
All right, so in They Live, you needed special sunglasses to see through the hologram disguise of the aliens among us.
That's right.
But George Nada, the character in 8 o'clock in the morning, woke up from hypnosis during a show, some entertainment he was watching, but he woke up out of a deeper trance. What does that symbolize? Because you wake up, everybody else wakes up, and they're back in reality, but something else happened to this character.
Well, what I intended to happen in the original story was that he was just a little bit farther from being hypnotized than the rest of the people in the audience, so he could see through the hypnotic suggestion. And that didn't photograph well. We needed something that people could see on the screen other than just somebody changing his mind. And there was a tourist gadget at Venice, you know, a part of Los Angeles, that looks like a Venetian blind, only it's sunglasses. We first thought we would use that, but then John thought it was too close to something that everybody knew about, so we switched over to sunglasses with special properties. But we needed, first of all, we needed something that we could photograph, and that turned out to be the glasses. And we needed the source of the hypnosis to be visible and destroyable as an object. So we had that broadcasting device that was broadcasting the spell all over the world. There's no change in the basic idea, but there is an adaptation to the needs of the screen.
It must have been really interesting to be on the set and work with John Carpenter on this idea. Now, I want to talk a little bit more about the dynamic of hypnosis in 8 o'clock in the morning.
Okay.
You called the monsters Fascinators.
And that's it.
Why that name?
Well, because the essence of hypnosis is to fascinate somebody, to grab their attention so that they don't actually see anything outside of what you want them to see. And the first title of the story was actually The Fascinator, but the editor thought that was too pulpy, and so we switched to 8 o'clock in the morning.
It reminds me also of vampires and the glamour.
Mm-hmm. Yep, there's the connection there, all right.
All right, so you point out that the Fascinators, which are the disguised lizards, needed to also be convinced of their hypnotic domination over humans for the spell to work.
Ah, that is the clinical description of what happens in hypnosis. The guy who's doing the hypnotizing has to show absolutely no lack of confidence in the activity or it won't work. And that is something that I've seen, as I say, in my experiences with Scientology. That Scientology doesn't work unless the person who's administering it is confident that it will work.
So if you start to break the confidence of your oppressors, then you start to gain an advantage.
Yes, 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 especially if there are a whole lot of you and only a few of him. That's the case, as we see, with the one percenters.
Yes, it is. I noticed the idea of good lizards helping humanity is used in V, for example. Is that something you considered for They Live?
That's what happens in the thus far unfilmed second version of the story. It was supposed to be a trilogy, but it only managed to squirm its way to the screen once before people started to, or especially the Republicans who were putting the money behind it, discover what it really was. But as I say, we have another protagonist. He manages to go to the home planet, stir up a revolution among what we might call the good space monsters. So we were all set to do that particular variation, but we never got to do it.
Do you think now maybe John Carpenter or somebody else could put that sequel together?
I think it's harder now. I think we're being watched much more intently and with much more high-tech than ever before in history. So you don't have to go very far off the beaten path before an alarm goes off somewhere. I imagine that somebody is listening to this telephone call and recording it. Wouldn't surprise me.
Our guest is science fiction writer Ray Nelson. We're talking about his short story, 8 o'clock in the morning. We'll return after the break. If you're just tuning in, we're talking with science fiction author Ray Nelson about the political undercurrents of the film They Live, which was based on Ray's short story, 8 o'clock in the morning. Has anyone approached you or approached John? I don't know who has the rights to this sequel. It's just sitting dormant. It seems like, why couldn't an independent filmmaker take this on?
Well, it's because the studio owns the copyright.
Okay, right. If somebody creates an alternative They Live, they'd have to call it something else and a different storyline.
That's true. It'd have to be so much different, they might as well just start from scratch and make a new movie. One of the things that is hard to deal with, but it's one of the facts of life, is that all the movie studios are owned by multinational corporations that get to say no to any project. And so at this time, that wasn't the case when we made our film. Now the gates are a lot more locked than they were way back in the 60s.
Well, Ray, we're going to hear a short clip from the movie They Live. This is the beginning part, and the construction workers are walking through the Occupy camp and talking about their life.
Up soon. Good start.
Whoa!
Well, you get a chance to meet some of the folk.
This here's Gilbert. Anything you need, he knows where to find it.
Hi.
Howdy. All right.
You got that pack? Tools?
Yes, sir.
Well, if you can use them, we can use you. The shower's caving in over there.
Let's get some meat.
There you go. Howdy.
Yes, please. Some more?
Yes.
Please?
I got a wife and two kids back in Detroit. Haven't seen them in 6 months. Steel mills were laying people off left and right. They finally went under. We gave the steel companies a break when they needed it. You know what they gave themselves? Raises. The golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rules. They close one more factory. We should take a sledge to one of their fancy foreign cars.
You know, you ought to have a little more patience with life.
Yeah, well, I'm all out. The whole deal's like some kind of crazy game. They put you at the starting line, and the name of the game is make it through life. Only everyone's out for themselves and looking to do you in at the same time. Okay, man, here we are. Here we are. Now, you do what you can. But remember, I'm going to do my best to blow your ass away. So how are you going to make it?
I deliver a hard day's work for my money. I just want the chance. It'll come. I believe in America. I follow the rules. Everybody's got their own hard times these days.
Our impulses are being redirected. We are living in an artificially induced state of consciousness that resembles...
Do you remember that scene?
Oh, very well. That's one where I kind of directly attack the idea that competition is what we should all be doing. But there's a philosophy behind the one percenters that they can just pat themselves on the back for being the one percenters because they won the struggle for survival. But the whole picture of society as a place where everyone is at war with everyone else is flawed, and it's not really the best way to have a good life. It's not really the best way to survive. So they might just as well be hypnotized. And I think that in that particular scene, I really land a blow to the stomach to the competitive society.
Well, many years later, after you wrote 8 O'Clock in the Morning, you began to work with John Carpenter, and... Mm-hmm. Turn it into a feature-length film titled They Live.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell listeners about that experience?
Well, that experience began when somebody in Hollywood, probably John Carpenter's first readers, if he's got such a thing, they said, hey, this looks like a story in this comic book that might make a good movie in there. So Carpenter's lawyer phoned me up and informed me that they were interested in making a movie. Would I be interested in signing over the movie rights? And by various adroit and diplomatic means, I managed to get the right to be one of the writers of the film. The story is that Carpenter's lawyer called me and said, we want to make a movie, and I said, okay. And I managed to bargain myself into being one of several people who were going to have a collective pen name called Frank Armitage. John and Roddy and I and maybe Roddy's girlfriend, John's girlfriend, yeah, that's it. We were all going to be the author under the same pen name, and that's the name that appears as the scriptwriter, though Frank Armitage as a person doesn't exist. There's one scene in there that in the script as I wrote it is blank pages, and that's that big wrestling match between Roddy and his friend That is in there because Roddy thought that his fans, as a professional wrestler, would be very disappointed if somebody didn't wrestle somewhere in the movie. So after the whole movie was done, Roddy and his friend and some photographers went out in the alley behind the Universal Pictures offices and bashed each other all the Sunday. And then there's one scene after that where you see them with all these bruises and things and wounds, and they're in this room, and they say, "Ain't love grand?" The thing is, all those wounds are real. That's not makeup. That was actually shot. That was the very last shot in the movie, but that was after the second-to-last shot, which was a big fight scene that was in there because Roddy didn't want to disappoint his wrestling fans.
That, it did look painful.
Yeah, but the thing that my serious fans noticed was that in the scene immediately following the scene where they say, "Ain't love grand," there's not a mark on them. They looked like they were brought up in an orphanage or something. There's no bruises, no wounds, nothing. And yet, had this been reality, they would still have all these wounds and bruises all over them.
I think I read it somewhere online that fight scene encapsulates the struggle between somebody who knows what's going on in this reality or sees the alternate reality and is trying to convince somebody who doesn't want to find out. And it symbolizes that in some way.
Well, in the way I visualize the scene, the argument was verbal, not physical. There's an argument there, but nobody hits anybody. If we structured it right, I could have Roddy say a few really convincing things. Then they would be allies from then on.
How might that argument have gone, Ray?
Well, at the present time, I forget. It was written down, but I don't have it in front of me. And I've kind of forgotten it since we didn't actually shoot it that way.
How long did it take to shoot this film? You know, overall, you know, reflecting back on the whole process, how do you look back on this?
I thought it was a barrel of fun. I enjoyed it greatly, and I didn't keep track of the time. But just as a guess, I would say it was about 6 months.
What was the initial reaction from the film when it was released?
Well, all the science fiction fans went into ecstasy. And the curator of the Pacific Film Archive says it was the best science fiction movie of all time. And Vogue magazine, they said it was the best science fiction picture of the year. And there was a guy named Joe Bill something or another at the drive-in, and he said that it was a swinging success. But at that point, nobody, at least in print, had noticed the sneaky political undertones. And the sneaky political undertones only appeared when John Carpenter did an interview for a science fiction movie fan magazine, in which he revealed the terrible truth about our political machinations.
What I find interesting, again, just to revisit this idea, is that it can be, it doesn't have to be Republicans. It could be any oppressive group that you could substitute.
Yeah, for sure.
But to stop a sequel makes me think that you guys, whether intentionally or not, were onto something here.
Yeah, we struck a nerve. I'm sure that's true. But all the people, they didn't have to exactly well fund anything. All they had to do was cut off the supply of funds that they were already supplying.
The idea that there are beings among us that are hidden among humanity. They look like human beings, but they're not really human beings. And humans interact with them.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're human, and these monsters don't kill the humans. They just take advantage of the environment that these humans live in, and
exactly.
climb up on the shoulders of human beings. They get the promotions, they make more money, they are the wealthy. And it is a type of feeding, like a slow feeding, a parasitical relationship in a way.
That's right. Well, Anne Rice thought a good simile would be vampires. She had the vampires living amongst us undetected. So it's actually the same basic idea behind my ideas and Phil Dick's ideas and Anne's ideas, and which isn't surprising because we were meeting every Thursday here in my house and talking about those ideas.
To explore these parallel timelines, the possibility of an invasive species living alongside human beings that look just like humans is really a brilliant idea and plot for.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the real resistance on the higher levels of finance in the film industry to stop any kind of sequel and to stop this from getting out. And again, you could call it Republicans, you can call it the 1%, you can call it whatever, but it is the structure of the idea, the plot structure is something, even though it is science fiction, it was stopped. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that they finally realized that they were being threatened, and they hadn't realized that before. They thought they were just making a cheap vampire movie, and you may have noticed there are almost no special effects or sets. So, and there's no major stars in that movie. So it was produced on a shoestring, as movies go, and they thought, oh boy, we're going to spend a little money and make a lot, and they never bought it. They never bothered to figure out what the movie was about. Oh, dear. It's not that the one percenters are so smart. They just happen to have had a good inheritance.
In the film, these beings that could only be seen through these sunglasses that were manufactured by the an underground resistance group had looked down on humanity. Even though they lived alongside humanity and human beings, they seemed to get along with those who had made as much money as them, but those who didn't, they regarded as lower class. And was that your idea to do that?
Oh, definitely. What was in my mind at the time that I did that part of it was the conditions of slavery in the United States, where black people were considered to be an inferior race, but there was also the good Negro, like on what they call Uncle Tom, and they were higher up on the totem pole than the ones in the field. So this is kind of analogous to the situation of slavery in the United States.
I like the scene where the main character is in that grocery store and the woman realizes that her real form is viewable by this person.
And then she starts talking on her wrist radio. She's saying that there's one of them here who can see us. Oh, that's a terrific scene. I love it.
Are there other key scenes in the film They Live, based on your short story, 8 o'clock in the morning, that you find significant here at this time right now?
Well, you hit two of the good ones, but the one that you haven't really delved into was the destruction of the occupiers' camp. And I'm particularly dismayed and pleased at the same time that we managed to so accurately predict something that was going to happen in the future that wasn't even scientific. I think that is the place where we got away with saying the most.
You had these machines bulldozing tents in a field.
That's it.
Unfortunately, there wasn't a resistance group that made those sunglasses. Maybe soon.
It's building. There's a group called Bioneers that meets every year over in Marin County, and people who are actually doing something about stuff. They're speaking and meeting there. If you want to track it down, Bioneers, it's called.
binaries.
Kind of a convention for people with futuristic ideas.
What technologies and lifestyle changes that are here now, but were once a subject of science fiction stories early on in your writing career, have you noticed?
Well, I think that the most interesting is actually in the field of physics. A lot of the stories that I and Phil and even Anne were writing depend on the idea that there's more than one universe, an alternate universe. And also popping up in stories that we write is the idea that there are sources of energy which have not yet been discovered, which are now being called dark energy, dark matter. And the universe, which was supposed to be slowing down as it expanded, turns out to be speeding up. And we have to ask the question, where is the energy coming to speed it up? So I think the long-range potential of ideas that are now actually on the table for real scientists, that's where the amazing stuff is going to turn up.
And zero-point energy as well.
You got it.
Ray, there's a reoccurring undercurrent in your work describing the resistance to oppressive forces in society, such as unemployment, a stealth alien invasion, or a small group of people rising to the top and ruling the world. You did it again by predicting what might have happened here, because we see these billionaires in these yachts, we see these Google barges that are in international waters. This political message is obvious to some people, but what do you see now reflecting back on your work?
Well, I have to admit, I'm very proud of what I've done. Some people might want to have me arrested, but so far they haven't been knocking on my door. I'd rather they wouldn't, because it's too late. I've already gotten my message out.
Ray Nelson, I want to thank you for being on the show. It's just wonderful to speak with you about this incredible career that you've had, writing science fiction, but the crown jewel of those stories are 8 o'clock in the morning and They Live, and that concept right there. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
That was a 2014 interview with the late science fiction cartoonist and author Ray Nelson. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.